Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
This MLB season, FanDuel's Dinger Tuesday is back. And this year, all customers get a profit boost to bet home runs every week. So gear up to go yard all season long on FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in select states. Opt-in required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable profit boost tokens. Restrictions apply, including any token expiration and max wager amount. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and I have a co-host with me today that has been highly requested that I bring her back, and it's Daisy.
Hello. Hello.
Welcome, Daisy. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Absolutely. I think we know why I'm here, though, and I think it's called motherload guilt.
Oh. Okay, so totally busted. Yes, so we do have a podcast, a sister podcast called The Motherload that originally was going to be, you know, maybe me, Carolyn, and Daisy.
You know, just in the early stages, we threw it around.
We did.
We hashed it out a little, but imagine my surprise when I'm scrolling through Facebook. Oh, look at the new podcast, The Motherload.
She's not bitter, but I am going to make her probably a little more regular on here because it's nice to be able to tell people stories, and Austin's always
so busy and unavailable, and I don't like just talking to myself, so.
And honestly, it's not their fault. I mean, I canceled on Kelly like 7 different times before. I feel like maybe she thought I wasn't, you know, going to be as responsible.
Maybe she just doesn't want to do this, but doesn't want to hurt my feelings.
You know. No, I do. I'm just so busy. I put on some neck cream for the second time today that I bought a month ago, that literally I wanted to tighten my neck, and all you have to do is put it on every night, and I've done it twice in 1 month. So,
and both of those times were this morning?
No, I did it the day it came because I was real excited about opening up the box. And then today I'm like, oh, maybe I should. I mean, I've literally laid in bed and I'm like, ooh, I should go get that neck cream, but it's all the way in the bathroom, so.
Yeah, oh, I've totally had that. Or same with brushing my teeth. I know that sounds so gross, but like,
I know.
Sometimes I'll have like a cookie in bed, a cookie or like 10 Oreos, because I have no self-control. But I will do that, and then I'm like, oh, I gotta walk all the way over there and brush my teeth.
I know.
This sucks.
Spray tan is another one where I'm like, oh, I should go downstairs and spray tan, because I mean, I've just got like my own little thing, not like a big commercial, you know, thing. But and then I'm like, I'm too lazy. And then I have to tell myself, when you're too lazy to spray tan, Daisy, I think it's maybe time to take a look at yourself.
Okay. Take a good, long, hard look.
I mean, we're not talking about too lazy to exercise. We're talking about too lazy to spray tan. Okay?
Yeah. No, so. I feel you. It's honestly because I'm just exhausted by the end of the day. That's why I don't wear makeup.
But you have a toddler and a baby. My youngest is 16, so what's my excuse? I am busy. I'm busy with work, so.
You know. You are busy. You were just telling me how busy you are. And you are a mortgage lender?
I am a mortgage lender. Well, I'm a mortgage loan officer.
Loan officer.
Yes. A lender, I guess. So, yes, I help people get mortgage loans. So I specialize in first-time home buyers. So I work a lot with people that don't know what they're doing at all. But that's okay because that's what I'm here for.
But that would take a lot of time having to explain
that
whole process.
It does, but I like it. I mean, it's all about them trusting me and communication and everything. And so I've made like so many friends, really, you know, and just like some that just bought a house last year, then they just had a baby, or they just had another baby or whatever. And I see it on Facebook and I'm just proud of them because, you know, it's what they're doing. They're doing it.
They're living the dream.
Yeah.
All right. Well, today we are talking about a case that you have not heard of. Is that correct?
No, you told me the name and that's it. It took me, I had to sit on my hands because I wanted to Google it, but I did not.
Okay.
I'm going in blind.
I am proud of you. Okay. Well, today we are talking about Molly Watson. Molly Watson was just 2 days away from the happiest day of her life, a fairy tale wedding to the man that she believed was her soulmate. But instead of walking down the aisle, Molly's body was found on a remote Missouri back road, shot execution style in what looked like a targeted killing. As investigators began digging into her life, they uncovered a secret that would flip the case upside down and reveal a double life so twisted it stunned even seasoned detectives. So this is the story of Molly Watson. Molly Nicole Watson was born December 15th, 1982, in Moberly, Missouri. Do you know where Moberly is?
I don't. I mean, I've heard of Moberly.
So Moberly is about 40 minutes north of Columbia, just east of Kansas City, I guess.
Okay.
But probably
So you passed through it on the way to Columbia then?
Yeah, well, I guess no, because it would be north of Columbia. So if we were traveling, it would be straight east. We're like in Kansas City.
I'm not a doctor, Kelly. I don't know.
It doesn't really matter. So we'll just keep going. So Molly grew up in a tight-knit family in northern Missouri. Her parents, Tim and Sandy Watson, raised Molly and her brother in the small town of Huntsville, which is just west of Moberly. Now, people who knew Molly described her as kind, creative, and devoted to her family. She even had a young son of her own, Declan, and loved being a mom. Family was everything to Molly. She was the kind of person who spent weekends with her parents and was exceptionally close with them and her brother. Aside from her day jobs, Molly had a creative, entrepreneurial streak. She loved nail art and even started her own indie nail polish line called Shine Spark Polish. Is that like similar to Jamberry, or what is that called?
Oh, yeah, Jamberry and...
like the stuff that you,
they're
the
like
little
stickers,
sheets that you put on. Yeah. But there's another one too. I can't remember what. When they first came out, you had to use a blow dryer.
Really?
Yes. You put them on and then you like, they were almost like a shrink wrap.
Yeah.
And you put heat on it.
Can you imagine?
I know.
Using those
heat
things?
Yeah.
With this company, she designed custom polishes and sold them online. And friends in the nail art community really admired her talent and her passion. And this wasn't really a huge moneymaker for her or anything. It was mostly just a hobby turned small business. But it just shows how full of life and ideas Molly was. Not everyone has the mindset to turn their hobby into a small business, but she poured creativity into everything she did. By her late 20s, Molly was working a steady job and raising her son, Declan. In early 2010s, she took a position as a corrections officer at the Moberly Area Correctional Center, which is a prison in town. And it was a solid job with benefits, and Molly wasn't afraid of hard work. But little did she know, this job would also be where she met the man who became the love of her life, a coworker, not an inmate.
Okay, because I thought I could see, I knew where it was going, and I'm like,
face.
Oh, Molly, 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 you cannot reform them. Stay away from the prisoners.
they can't be
no.
saved. No, I'm just kidding. Sometimes they can. Okay.
Well, yeah. But.
Anyway, this guy was a coworker named James Addy.
Okay. All right.
So James Addy was a fellow corrections officer at Moberly, and he was quite a bit older than Molly. When they met around 2011, Molly was about 29 years old, and James was in his early 50s.
Mm, there it is.
Despite the age difference, Molly fell head over heels for him. Her brother, Tim, later said that Molly was absolutely 100% in love with James. And for Molly, who had already been married once before, and that was Declan's father, who's now out of the picture, James seemed like a second chance at love and happiness and a secure family unit. Now, a quick side note about James Addy, because he's central to this story. At first glance, James was a quiet, unassuming guy. He had been married before. In fact, James had been married multiple times, and Melanie was wife number 4, so Molly would have been wife number 5. Now, we don't know much about those earlier marriages, and Molly's family didn't either, but what we do know is that by 2011, James had been married for many years to a woman named Melanie and had 2 children, a teenage daughter, Emma, and a son named Ben. Now, it's not clear exactly when Molly learned that James was married. According to one friend, Molly knew that he was married, that he definitely had a wife, but believed that he had planned on leaving her when their daughter went off to college. So for 7 years, James carried on this affair with Molly behind his wife Melanie's back.
Just, I mean, how big of a basket do you need to collect all those red flags? I mean,
that's a lot of laundry.
Wow.
That's a full load. I can't even imagine the balancing act. Like, how do you sleep at night, first of all?
I know.
When you are just living a complete double life. But James would finish his shifts at the prison at 3 p.m., and Melanie later recalled that he often didn't get home until 5 p.m. or later. So when she'd ask why he was late, he'd get defensive and give evasive answers.
Exactly. They get defensive right away. Mm-hmm. Did Melanie know?
Well, not at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. So it gets twisted. In reality, he was likely squeezing in time with Molly, obviously, and he even managed to take Molly on a couple of trips, one to Disney World in Florida, which, as we'll see, is fitting given Molly's love for Disney, and another romantic trip to Mexico.
I mean, I know they didn't have GPS and Life 360 and all that, but in any way, shape—
Oh! Was that not a thing?
Oh, yeah. No. Okay, so in any way, shape, or form, could Austin possibly take another woman to Disneyland and you not know?
Absolutely
Are
not.
You kidding me right now? I mean, you know.
I mean, I guess when you're in your 50s,
I'm 51. Hello.
But it's 2025. So I feel like in 2011, maybe, I don't know, I'm trying to make excuses to how and why this could happen.
No way, no how, no where. I mean, if you're gone for 24 hours, I mean, if I didn't know my husband's where, and I'm not a jealous person, I don't, you know, I mean, golf a little longer, please. I can do whatever I want. But
yeah.
I mean, even if he was gone for, if there was like a 12-hour period that I didn't know where he was.
Yeah.
That would be, you know.
Right. Like, is he telling her that these are work trips
right.
or something?
It
and she's
must
just
be,
none the wiser?
Because there would be zero way for either one of us to have any sort of overnight you know.
Yeah. And how are you paying for that at right? Disney World?
Yeah, exactly.
And you're not taking either of your kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of red flags for you too, Melanie. What happened yeah. here? So apparently to cover his tracks, James did lie to Melanie that these trips were either work-related or, like, guys' getaways. Who's taking guys' trips to Disney World?
We're heading to see Mickey, okay? The yeah. old Mick. Just the guys and I. No.
I don't think so. And he was able to convince Melanie because she had said that she never really knew his work friends, so it seemed plausible. I don't understand that kind of mentality. Clearly, you don't either, but apparently she had no idea her husband was off making memories with another woman. And Molly, for her part, was all in on this relationship. Friends recall her being so excited whenever she talked about James. And despite the secrecy, Molly seemed convinced that James was her soulmate and that eventually they'd build a life out in the open. She even introduced him to some of her family as her boyfriend, though it doesn't sound like James spent much time around them. In fact, Molly's family was skeptical of James from the start. Her father, Tim Watson, noticed that James was very evasive and he could never look you in the eye, he said, which also a red flag. Others in Molly's family got bad vibes from him, and some relatives were so uneasy about the whole situation that they later admitted they weren't sure they'd even attend Molly and James's wedding if it ever happened. Still, Molly was an adult and deeply in love, and she stood by James, defending him to her family. By early 2018, after roughly 7 years together, Molly was eager to make things official. Sure enough, James Addy proposed to Molly in 2018, and she said yes. This was a dream come true for Molly. Finally, the man she loved was going to be publicly hers. And they started planning a wedding for the end of April of 2018, just as James had promised. The theme was Disney-themed, Molly's favorite. She decided on, well, she and James apparently decided on a Beauty and the Beast-themed wedding with burgundy and gold decorations and lots of Disney magic. And Molly was ecstatic. The wedding planner, Sam Cohen, remembered how giddy Molly was over every detail. From Molly's perspective, it was going to be a beautiful wedding and the best day ever. Hair and makeup artist Crystal Graves and Tabitha Shilb recalled that she was so excited. They had been working on a wedding that was Beauty and the Beast, very Disney themed. They had worked out all the details and it was going to be her fairy tale day.
Disney theme is fine, but Beauty and the Beast? I mean,
is that a little foreshadowing?
Right.
Yeah.
Is he still with Melanie?
No.
At this time?
No.
Okay.
Oh, well.
Supposed? Was he? Okay.
We'll get there.
There wasn't any. I actually divorced her.
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay, because if I was Molly, I'd want proof.
I would want proof, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So James's attitude about the wedding raised some eyebrows. Sam Cohen, the planner, said that James was kind of the opposite of Molly, that he was very quiet, didn't show much enthusiasm, and said, quote, "I thought he was just a groom along for the ride," which it's not unusual for grooms to be less into wedding planning, but given what I know now, James' lack of enthusiasm might have been something else entirely, like dread, maybe?
Yeah.
Still, the planning marched on. Invitations went out, venues were booked, dresses and suits arranged, all the usual chaos of wedding prep. Yet James continued to be evasive and even uncooperative at times. At one point, he kept postponing meetings with the wedding planner, claiming he had urgent personal matters to attend to. Specifically,
like his other family.
It's not funny. Sorry. Specifically, James told people, including Molly, that his ex-wife Melanie had been in a terrible car accident and had died after being taken off of life support. He said he was busy dealing with the funeral arrangements at the time that he's planning this wedding.
Okay. Did she die?
Well,
you can't tell me now.
This.
Because I'd be looking up the obit. That was what, I mean.
Oh, yeah. Just wait. You just wait. Now, this lie is on a whole other level. Not only was Melanie not James's ex, they were still married. She was also very much alive and well at that time. James concocted this fake tragedy seemingly to explain why he had to duck out of wedding tasks and perhaps to garner sympathy from Molly and others. If his ex-wife died only weeks before his new wedding, then no one would be surprised if he was distracted or somber. And it's a pretty twisted plan, and it hints at James's desperation to just juggle these two worlds. By mid-April 2018, just a couple of weeks before the ceremony, some of Molly's family members were openly voicing that they didn't really like James. In fact, Molly's aunt, or friend of the family, Carol Lindbergh, gently told Molly she might not attend the wedding. In a text, she excused herself by half-joking, quote, "You know how I feel about weddings and funerals. I kind of avoid them," end quote. And Carol never would have imagined how prophetic her words were. Now, despite the tension, Molly remained determined to marry James. On April 25th of 2018, 2 days before the wedding date, the couple went to the Randolph County Recorder's Office to get their marriage license. Now, this should have been a routine task, but it turned into another odd incident. Mark Price, the county recorder, asked James the standard questions for the marriage license form, like, have you been married before? And how did that marriage end? Things that are required by law. You also have to answer if you're related, which I think is funny. On those forms, you have to, like, I guess because they have to let you know that, like,
anywhere in Missouri or just in Moberly?
Well, I think, like, anywhere in the country.
Really?
Yeah, because I remember having to say, like, we are not related. He's not my cousin. Like, I had to explicitly say that Austin was not my relative.
That's crazy.
I know. But anyway, so this guy is asking him these standard questions, and according to the county recorder, James was just confused at the questions, saying, quote, he seemed perturbed. He was just like, why do you need to know that? And then James lied to the recorder, stating that he and his wife, Melanie, had divorced and that she had subsequently died in a car accident. Mark Price remembered James's irritated demeanor clearly because it struck him as odd at the time. But with nothing to do but accept the answers, he issued the license in the names of Molly Watson and James Addy. Now, with the marriage license secured and just about 48 hours to go, Molly was on cloud nine. Meanwhile, James was scrambling behind the scenes, and we later learned that on April 26th, the very next day, Molly's phone records show that she did something telling. She searched online for an obituary, or death notice, for Melanie Addy. So it seems Molly was double-checking James's car accident story, and maybe she had a gut feeling that things weren't adding up.
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly, no obituary existed. Melanie Addy was alive, so of course, Molly found nothing. This must have raised serious alarm bells for Molly, and we don't know if she directly confronted James on the 26th about her discovery, but it's very likely she asked him questions or intended to. What we do know is James texted Molly that day saying, quote, the funeral is tomorrow, referring to his supposed ex-wife's funeral. Then he wrote, quote, I'm sorry, sweetness. I love you so, so much, trying to reassure her. Perhaps he hoped that this lie would buy him time, and maybe Molly would postpone the wedding if she believed her fiancé was burying his former spouse on the eve of their nuptials. But it didn't work. If anything, James's wild story sped up his day of reckoning. Molly was now very suspicious. On April 26th, she was seeking the truth about Melanie. By the morning of April 27th, Molly Watson likely realized that her fiancé was feeding her a pack of lies. James wasn't divorced. His wife wasn't dead. If Molly had fully figured this out, she would know James Addy was not free to marry her at all. And one can only imagine her emotional state of confusion, betrayal, and anger. According to prosecutors, they believe Molly did confront James, or was about to. And this brings us to the tragic climax of our story, the night of April 27th, 2018. So Friday the 27th was supposed to be the final exciting countdown to Molly's wedding day. Instead, it became the last day of her life. So
this was the day before her wedding, mm-hmm. like the rehearsal day. Oh, my God.
So let's go through what happened step by step in real time. That day, Molly went about making final arrangements. James actually swung by the wedding venue in the afternoon to drop off some centerpieces and decorations. The planner, Sam Cohen, noted nothing unusual in his demeanor. He was just quiet as always. As Sam walked James out, she casually asked, "Are you getting excited? I mean, it's 2 days until your wedding," which is a pretty fair question. And James' reply was a bit blunt. He said that Molly was driving him crazy.
Oh.
Bad sign. Sam later remembered thinking the comment was odd, but she shrugged it off at the time. In hindsight, James was likely extremely on edge. His two worlds were about to collide at the wedding, and Molly was pressing him about Melanie's supposed death, so you can imagine the pressure was mounting. That evening, Molly was at home in Huntsville, likely with her parents. She and her son lived very close to them, possibly even together, but at least like on the same property. So sometime after 7 p.m., James called Molly on her cell phone, and we know this because phone records later showed a 22-minute call between them that evening. During this call, James likely convinced Molly to meet up with him so they could talk things out privately. Now, whatever he said, he was urgent enough that Molly literally left in her slippers, and according to her brother, she, quote, grabbed her slippers, threw them on, grabbed her coat, and told her mom and dad, I'm going to meet James for a little bit. I'll be right back. So James directed Molly to a very remote location, a dirt back road in rural Monroe County, which is not far from the town of Middle Grove. Specifically, it was near a low water creek crossing off Route M, which is an isolated spot where James often went fishing and knew the area pretty well. It was dark by then, and Molly drove out there, still on the phone with James during the roughly 22-minute drive. It appears James stayed on the other line with her until she was close. The time was probably around 8 p.m. or shortly after when Molly arrived at the desolate location. What happened next is pieced together from forensic evidence and a critical eyewitness who happened upon the scene. This eyewitness was Glenn McSparren, a local man who was driving through that area twice that night. Glenn's mother lived nearby, and he often took that back road as a shortcut. At about 8:30 p.m., as Glenn was driving his daughter to his mom's house, he encountered something unusual on the dirt road. In the beam of his headlights, Glenn saw two cars near the low water crossing. One was stopped by the crossing, and another was coming toward him from the opposite direction. So Glenn slowed down, thinking perhaps a car was stuck in the creek, because low water crossings can be tricky. And the car approaching him was a light-colored, older model sedan. He later described it as a big grandma car being driven by an older white male who was, quote-unquote, quote, short.
Beast-like, if you will.
Beast. Beastly. That description, as you may guess, fits James Addy, who is a shorter man in his 50s. The sedan's headlights were bright and angled such that Glenn couldn't see everything clearly, but he did notice another vehicle parked off to the side, facing away, presumably Molly's car in the creek bed area. So Glenn, thinking someone might need help, pulled up and rolled down his window. He shouted to the older man, "Hey, is somebody stuck down there?" James stepped partially out of his car but stayed near his door, and Glenn couldn't see him well due to the glare of the headlights, but he heard the man answer in a dismissive tone, "I don't know where they're at. It's going to be a while." Essentially, the stranger was implying that whoever was in the car was not around at the moment and that Glenn should just move along. The man even suggested Glenn take a different route to avoid the area. Glenn later recalled feeling that something about this interaction was off. The whole scene didn't sit right with him.
Right.
He saw the older guy's car sliding back and forth a bit as if trying to get traction or perhaps trying to push the other car, and the older man's demeanor was just strange. So Glenn did leave initially. He backed his truck up and went around as directed, continuing on to drop off his daughter. But that gut feeling just kept nagging him. So after about 30 minutes, having dropped off his child and spoken with his brother and mom, Glenn decided to drive back through the area to make sure everything was all right. It was now 9 p.m. or a little after, and as he was returning to the creek crossing, the scene was quiet. The grandma car and the older man were gone, but as Glenn's headlights cut across the darkness, they illuminated something horrifying, a body lying on the ground in front of a car. It was a woman's body face down on the dirt. Glenn stopped and realized with shock that it was the driver of the other vehicle, and she was not moving. So Glenn McSparren immediately dialed 911. He then approached carefully to check the person, and later, speaking to ABC's 2020, Glenn said, quote, "When I saw her, I swear my heart stopped. I could tell she wasn't moving." The woman on the ground was 35-year-old Molly Watson, and tragically, she was already dead. Glenn immediately called 911, and that call set off the investigation that would unravel James Addy's double life. So let's just pause and consider the crime scene as the first officers arrived. This is rural Missouri, pitch dark, and the only illumination is from patrol car headlights and flashlights. Molly's black Ford SUV was found near the shallow creek. Her body was in front of the vehicle as if she had gotten out or been standing by the hood when she was killed. Investigators from the Monroe County Sheriff's Office and the Missouri State Highway Patrol rushed out to secure the scene. They found Molly's purse and other personal belongings still in the car or nearby, and crucially, her engagement ring was still on her finger, and her cash and valuables were not taken. So this immediately told police that robbery was not the motive. Whoever did this wasn't trying to steal from her. This was personal. So while examining the area, police noticed something was missing. Molly's cell phone was nowhere to be found. Given that most people keep their phone close, its absence suggested that the killer might have taken it. Investigators made a mental note to search for the phone, but they surveyed the ground for any immediate evidence. They observed tire tracks in the soft earth by the creek, impressions that didn't match Molly's vehicle. Casts and photographs of these tire treads were taken since they might later be compared to a suspect's car. Another deputy, while driving back to the scene in the dark, spotted something odd on the side of Route M, a road leading away from the crime scene. It was a discarded blue t-shirt lying in the road. Thinking it could be related, he picked it up, and that shirt turned out to be a jackpot piece of evidence. It had gunshot residue on it and Molly's blood on it. It appeared the killer might have used this shirt during the shooting, possibly to muffle the gun or wipe something off, and then threw it out of the car window while he was fleeing. In the same general vicinity, officers also found an empty box of .22 caliber ammunition tossed on the roadside along Route M. It was a Remington Thunderbolt .22 caliber ammo box, and all the bullets were gone. I can't help but think, like, what a stupid criminal to just literally leave a trail of breadcrumbs right back from the crime scene to you.
Right. Well, that's what I'm sitting here thinking, I'm like, okay, what really was his motive? Just that he, and it's not that he didn't want to hurt Molly's feelings, because obviously he was going to kill her. Mm-hmm. I guess he was trying to keep it from Melanie. You know, he knew that if he just broke it off with Molly, then Melanie would find out or whatever from mm-hmm. Molly. But killing her and creating this murder when her family knows that she was going to go meet him. Mm-hmm. There was no, you know, he didn't try to cover that up. So, yeah, he's like not thought about any, you know, yeah. Not that there's a good murderer and a bad murderer, but he didn't think about anything.
No, you're right. If his motive was to keep his life with Melanie intact, that was over long before he ever shot Molly.
Right.
Because there was a wedding planned. Everyone knew about it.
Yeah.
If he would have even just said, I'm not doing this. I'm calling off the wedding. I want to stay with Melanie. She was going to find out regardless.
Right.
And even killing Molly, it's like, that's going to make the news, don't you think, that this bride who was set to get married to James Addy, like, it just seems like there was no forethought.
If he had any, like, violence in his past. Because to me, this man's just a killer. I don't care if there wasn't a Melanie. I don't care if he was just going to marry her and there was no Melanie, there was no other family. I feel like later down the road, he would have killed her anyway. How he didn't, maybe you'll say, how did they look at any of the other wives or how they,
I don't think,
you know, so. Any of that. I mean, to me, this man's just a killer by nature.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's odd to me, too, that he worked in a correctional facility and had been surrounded by all of these inmates and still was so stupid regarding the crime that he committed.
Right. I would say he had to have had some violence and things in his past.
Yeah.
Something leading up to this. This is crazy that this is the first person that he's killed.
Yeah.
If he did it in this manner and this, you know.
And in such cold blood.
Right.
To just point a gun right at someone's head, this person that you're about to marry. That is just so cold.
Yeah.
Well, back at the creek, investigators carefully examined Molly's body. She had been shot one time at very close range, essentially point blank to the back of her head. The medical examiner would later confirm that it was a contact wound, so the gun barrel was pressed to her head, and the bullet's caliber was small, likely a .22 caliber. They recovered the bullet from her skull, but it was badly damaged, crushed beyond recognition, as the forensic report said. So they couldn't immediately match it to a specific firearm. There were no shell casings found at the scene, which suggests the killer might have used a revolver, which doesn't eject shells, or had picked up their casings. However, the presence of that .22 ammo box pointed strongly toward a .22 caliber firearm being used. Within a few hours, investigators had built the beginnings of a theory. Molly's fiancé would naturally be a person of interest, and the circumstances were highly suspicious. Here's a bride-to-be 2 days before her wedding, found murdered on a road that basically leads towards the home of her fiancé, with evidence like the marriage license in her car and her engagement ring on her hand, emphasizing this whole wedding connection.
Well, plus you would think that they would talk to her family, who's the last people that saw her, and say, well, where was she heading? She was heading to meet her fiancé.
Yeah,
so.
She was literally on the phone with him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Officers at the scene actually found the couple's marriage license in the back seat of Molly's SUV with, of course, James Addy's name on it. So this gave them James' identity and address very quickly. They also located an online wedding registry for Molly and James, which just further confirmed who he was. Just after midnight, law enforcement was en route to James Addy's house, which was roughly a 30-minute drive from where Molly's body was found. They intended to perform the grim duty of notifying him that his fiancée was dead, and let's be honest, to also size him up as a potential suspect at the same time. It was around 2:45 a.m. when Missouri Highway Patrol Trooper Michael Langston and other officers knocked on James Addy's front door. But guess who answered the door?
Melanie?
Of course.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max Bundle. It's the ultimate bundle for an unbelievable price. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. Get it and watch Marvel Television's Ironheart on Disney Plus.
I want to build something iconic.
A new season of The Bear on Hulu.
We can make people happy.
And The Epic, a Minecraft movie on Max.
Anything you can imagine is possible.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max Bundle. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. All these and more now streaming. Terms apply. Visit DisneyPlusHuluMaxBundle.com for details.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
So let's talk a little more about who James is, what his life was like, because I just want to really give you the full picture of this story.
Okay, I have a full picture. James is an asshole.
He is, yes. Yeah, you're right. So we can just move on.
Go ahead, if we must.
So James lived in a modest home in Santa Fe, Missouri, which is near Mexico, Missouri.
I have heard of that.
Okay. With his wife, Melanie, and their teenage daughter. When officers arrived, they expected James to answer the door, likely half asleep, and then be devastated by the news of Molly's death. But instead, in a twist almost too bizarre to believe, they were greeted by Melanie Addy, James's wife of 23 years. Melanie was very much alive, so much for that dead ex-wife story. She looked confused to see police at her door in the middle of the night. And when one of the troopers asked for James, and James himself appeared, coming to the door in a bathrobe, officers politely requested to speak with him about an incident involving Molly. So at this point, Melanie was probably standing there wondering, who on earth is Molly? In fact, Melanie asked the officers, what are you doing here? Which is when Trooper Langston realized that something was very off. He hadn't expected another woman to be in James's house, let alone that woman to identify herself as James's wife. They literally just found the marriage certificate in Molly's car. So I'm sure in their minds, they're just like, what are we getting ourselves into?
And Melanie's like, it couldn't have been him because he was with his buddies in Disneyland.
Disney World.
Excuse me. Disney World.
There's a difference.
Florida. See, I thought you had said Disneyland before. Disney World.
Disney World.
Florida. Disneyland's California.
Yeah, I think it was in Florida. Imagine being Melanie in that moment. It's 2:45 in the morning and police show up to tell you that your husband has a fiance who has just been murdered. That's a lot.
Yeah, it is. But Melanie chose to ignore a lot of things, too.
Yeah, that is true, Melanie. At first, she might have thought that they were mistaken, but no, James had to come clean right then and there. One of the officers gently explained that a woman named Molly Watson, who was engaged to James Addy, had been found dead, and in that moment, in the middle of the night, Melanie's world flipped upside down. The officer separated James and Melanie immediately, which is standard procedure to interview them apart, But Melanie was understandably in tears and likely devastated and furious at James. She says that she asked him, who is Molly Watson? And James had to admit, she's my lover. Basically confessing to the affair right there on the spot. And quick pause for that moment, because for God's sake, if it was that easy to just drop the bomb on her in that moment, you could have spared Molly's life.
Exactly. Let's skip the murder.
Right. So, like, what was the point in even killing Molly if you admitted to it the same night you killed her? Like, there was maybe, what, a 5 or 6 hour span when you thought you had it all figured out. Meanwhile, investigators pulled James aside, away from Melanie and their daughter, to question him. At first, James tried to play the role of a grieving, innocent fiancé, albeit one who now had to admit he'd been cheating on his wife. He acknowledged the 7-year affair with Molly and that they were indeed engaged to be married in 2 days. With presumably a straight face, James claimed he had nothing to do with Molly's death. He started providing an alibi for that night. James told Trooper Langston and the others that on the evening of April 27th, he was going to see a friend at 7 o'clock. He elaborated that he drove out to a friend's house to pick up an avocado plant, of all things.
As you do.
And then came back home around 8:30. Now, this story was oddly specific, yet entirely uncorroborated at that moment. An avocado plant, not what you would usually expect to hear in a murder alibi, but the investigators kept their cool. As they spoke with James, they observed his body language closely. One officer noted that James became visibly hot and uncomfortable during his interview. He started sweating profusely despite the late hour's chill. In fact, James was sweating so much that he walked over to a window, opened it, and stuck a box fan in it to blow cool air into the room.
Now, let's just say if sweating means murder, then I'm guilty.
Lock me up.
I don't care what time of the day it is. I want to see a picture of James because I've got all kinds of images in my head, and I want to see if I'm even close to right.
Yeah, I'm curious to see. I just sent you a picture of him and Molly, and I want to know if he's what you thought he would be.
Oh, good. Technology. Well, that's no. Oh, so he is not a beastly fella. He's not big.
No, he's kind of skinny.
He is.
Yeah.
I hate him. I hate him so much.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, poor Molly.
Okay. I know. So investigators pressed on with questions, and James admitted that he had spoken to Molly on the phone earlier that evening, which matched the phone log that they already knew about. And importantly, he revealed that he had a secret phone, a purple cell phone that he kept hidden from his wife, used exclusively to communicate with Molly. He actually went and fetched this phone for the officers as if to appear cooperative, saying, quote, this is what I used to communicate with Molly. And boy, did that phone tell a story. On it, investigators saw that James and Molly spoke daily, a flurry of calls and texts typical of a romantic relationship. James even volunteered that the last time he spoke with Molly was a 22-minute call earlier that evening, the one where he likely lured her out. He conveniently did not mention that he was on the phone with her, likely as she drove to the murder site. However, what really raised eyebrows were the text messages on that secret phone. After Molly was dead, likely shot between 8 and 8:30, James had sent her a series of text messages later that night, obviously not realizing or pretending not to realize that she was dead. The text read like a normal conversation from a caring fiancé, almost as if he were trying to fabricate evidence that he was unaware of anything bad. One text from James asked, "What did you eat for supper?" And another said, "I love you so much." Getting no reply for obvious reasons, James eventually texted something along the lines of, "Night, night, sweetheart, I'll talk to you tomorrow." To the officers, these messages looked very suspicious, likely sent by James to create the illusion that he thought Molly was alive and well at the time, which Chris Watts did the same thing.
They all do it.
Why do they all do this?
They do. They all do it. I'm really worried about you. This is the third message I've left. It's not like you to not answer. They all do it.
They all do it. Scott Peterson did it.
Yep.
They all do it. Like, as if they are just so smart.
I know. I know. I'm going to send a
dumb cops.
Yeah.
Dumb dumbs. So to the officers, these messages obviously looked very suspicious. And it's a common tactic, sending texts or even calling a victim after you've killed them to feign ignorance. At this point, the troopers knew James's alibi was flimsy at best. Who was this friend with the avocado plant? He never provided a name on the spot.
Did he provide the avocado
plant? I don't actually know.
That's what I'm wondering.
But, you know, I mean, how hard is it to just say, like, oh, yeah, this mound of dirt is my avocado plant? Or, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know why that
would come into his brain.
I've never held an avocado plant. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it comes in a pot. I don't know. I eat avocados.
Yeah, I don't know. My son tried to harvest an avocado seed, and he spent months harvesting the seed because it's like a very finicky thing.
I can't imagine anybody grows a lot of them in Missouri. Yeah.
Yeah. And it ended up dying. So anyway, they're just very, very finicky plants. But most damning of all, of course, was the revelation of his double life. Motive is obviously a huge part of murder investigations, and here they had stumbled upon a pretty powerful one. James had been lying to everyone, and if Molly was exposing his lies, then he had a motive to silence her. Investigators might not have outright accused him that night on the spot, but they certainly had him at the top of their list. Before leaving the house, police asked for James' consent to search his vehicle, which he granted. They noticed that the tire tread on his car, which was a light blue Buick sedan matching the grandma car description, super sorry if you're listening to this while you drive a blue Buick sedan, but it apparently appeared consistent with the tracks found at the murder scene. They took photographs and would later compare casts. By the end of the night's encounter, things had completely flipped. James was no longer just the grieving fiancé. He was the prime suspect. Officers decided they had enough cause to take him into custody. And in the early morning of April 28th, James Addy was arrested and formally charged with first-degree murder and armed criminal action and the death of Molly Watson. In the weeks following the murder, investigators dug deeper, and the case against James Addy grew much stronger. So remember those tire tracks? A Missouri State Highway Patrol criminalist named James Crafton analyzed the impressions from the crime scene. He determined that the tracks matched the rear passenger tire of James's car. So it was obvious that James's Buick left those exact marks by the creek. And this, of course, placed his vehicle at the scene of the murder. James's defense would later try to challenge this evidence as unscientific, but the judge allowed it and the jury heard it. Next was the firearm evidence. When police searched James's property with warrants after his arrest, they found several guns in the house. One was a .22 caliber Marlin Glenfield rifle that belonged to James. At trial, a firearms expert testified that ammunition from that rifle was consistent with Remington Thunderbolt .22 rounds, the same type from the empty box found on Route M. The ammo box at the scene was likely a puzzle piece linking to James's stock of ammo at home. Unfortunately, because the bullet from Molly's head was too mangled, they couldn't do a traditional ballistics match to say this exact gun fired the shot. And it's worth noting, a .22 rifle is an unusual choice for an up-close murder. One might have expected, like, a handgun.
Right.
So to use a rifle is really extreme.
I wonder if she knew, like, if they were fighting and then he's like, I'm going to kill you. Was she shot in the back of the head, did you say? I mean, they might not have even been arguing. He might have, like, just gone out there to kill her. She turned around for I kind of hope that's what it was.
Yeah, I kind of do, too.
You know, that she just didn't know it. And didn't, yeah.
And, you know, it's possible James chose that rifle because it's quieter or because that's what he had available. But regardless, the circumstantial evidence strongly tied that rifle and ammo to the crime. And then there was that blue T-shirt. Lab tests confirmed that it had both Molly's blood and particles of gunshot residue on it. Investigators could infer that this was the shirt that was present during the shooting, possibly worn by James or at least used by him. Was it James's shirt? We don't know for certain, but it's likely he ditched it to get rid of evidence. Finding any of the victim's blood on a possession of the suspect is extremely incriminating, and James never gave a good explanation for that shirt. Now, the digital evidence from the phones became a crucial part of the case. Because remember, Molly's phone was missing at the scene, but investigators did eventually track it down. Actually, in a clever move, they subpoenaed Molly's cell carrier and Google data. At some point, they did find Molly's phone itself. It might have been found in a ditch later or recovered via a ping. It wasn't explicitly stated how, but they had her data. From her phone's GPS and records, they confirmed Molly drove directly from her house to the spot where she died, and that she was on the call with James for the whole drive. So James literally guided her to her death over the phone. What's more, forensic analysis of Molly's phone revealed those internet searches on April 26th for any obituary or news of Melanie Addy. In court, prosecutor Tally Smith highlighted this, saying, quote, "Forensic searches of Molly's phone indicated that the day before she was murdered, she was looking for Melanie Addy's obituary. Molly discovered that James's story about his wife's death was a lie. The jury heard that the very day before the murder, Molly effectively learned that James was deceiving her. She likely confronted him or threatened to expose him, and that could have been the trigger that set James's deadly plan into motion. And perhaps the most chilling evidence of all were text messages found on James's phone that he had bizarrely sent to himself on April 27th, shortly before the murder. So just so I make sure you understand, because I know it's confusing, you heard it right. James appears to have texted himself, likely on his work phone or personal phone, in an attempt to fabricate an excuse or psych himself up. So one text, presumably meant to be shown to his wife if needed, said, "Have a meeting tonight at 8, normal place, you have to be there." As if a coworker texted him about a late minute or a last minute like work meeting.
Okay.
So that could explain why he told Melanie he was going to a friend's, like he just wanted an alibi of being called away. But even more startling were texts where James seems to be giving himself a pep talk, saying, quote, "Don't be a bitch again. Let's go, man."
Oh, my gosh. He's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it took him that long to kill somebody is surprising.
Yeah. It sounded like James was psyching himself up to commit the murder, overcoming any hesitation. And when he says, "Don't be a bitch again," so, like, when did it fall apart? Yeah. When did you try to do it before and it didn't work out? That's scary.
No kidding.
So while forensic and digital evidence stacked up, Melanie Addy filed for divorce a few weeks after James's arrest. She was furious and devastated at his betrayal, saying in part, quote, "He had always been very hard on me about how a wife should act. And then he did this. He had an affair, and that's okay? No, we were done," end quote. She started cooperating fully with the prosecution, and in a search of the house, Melanie herself discovered hidden photos of James and Molly together at Disney World, tucked away in a loft storage area of their garage. These photos showed James and Molly looking like a happy couple on vacation, and it was proof of the depth of his deception, and Melanie was prepared to testify about how completely in the dark she had been. She never knew Molly existed until that awful night, which strongly underscored that Melanie had no motive to harm Molly.
Right. Because
some might have initially wondered if, like, a jealous wife was involved.
Yeah.
But here it was clear that Melanie knew nothing of the affair. Over 3 years had passed since Molly's death, and James, now in his mid-50s, continued to maintain his innocence. He insisted on going before a jury on the charges of first-degree murder and armed criminal action, to which he pleaded not guilty. The trial lasted about a week in late April of 2021. Prosecutors methodically laid out the double life and the mountain of evidence. They painted James as a man who would rather kill than have his lies exposed. Critically, Melanie Addy took the stand against her now ex-husband, for real this time, and this had to be one of the most dramatic moments. She testified that she had no knowledge of James's affair or engagement. She never suspected a thing. Melanie described the night police came, how James was supposedly home by 8:30 and in bed by 2 a.m. when she awoke, which was his cover story. She likely verified that James was not home between 7 and 8:30 since he left saying he was going out. She also told the jury about James's character, saying, quote, "He was a pretty selfish person, controlling and intimidating. It seemed like something he would do to fix a problem," detailing his capability for violence. And that line, "something he would do to fix a problem," is chilling. His own wife believed that he could resort to murder to solve issues. Their daughter Emma also testified. And in one exchange, prosecutors even asked Emma if she was aware that she had been on the guest list for her dad's wedding to Molly. So you can imagine her answer. She was likely baffled, since of course she knew nothing about it. And that question drove home just how James was planning to marry Molly without even telling his kids.
Right.
Essentially planning this, like, polygamous marriage, but, like, is it polygamy if the wives don't know about each other?
I don't think so. I mean, I guess to him it is, but yeah, it's not. But there was another red flag there for Molly. Again, not victim shaming, but you've never met his two children?
Yeah. In 7 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's, guys, these are red flags. Like, yeah. let this be a lesson to you.
Exactly.
Send this to somebody that needs to hear how obvious these red flags yeah. are if it seems even slightly correlated to their lives.
Right. I wonder what his defense lawyer could possibly have come up with as any kind of defense. I mean,
yeah. Well, throughout the trial, the defense tried to just poke holes. They argued the forensic evidence was circumstantial. The tire tracks could match many cars. The bullet couldn't be matched to James's gun. No one saw James pull the trigger, etc. So it was all just about trying to create doubt. I don't know. They also likely suggested, without any evidence, that somebody else maybe killed Molly, perhaps a random person or who knows. But given all that we've discussed, that is a really hard sell. Molly had no known enemies, and the coincidence of her secret fiancé lying about his wife and being seen at the scene was just too great to ignore. So after roughly a one-week trial, the case went to the jury, and it did not take them long. Deliberations lasted only about 2.5 hours. The evidence was overwhelming. On April 29th of 2021, the jury returned a verdict of guilty on both counts, first-degree murder and armed criminal action.
How long did it take them to?
2.5 hours.
Yeah.
So right now we're waiting on the Karen Reed verdict. So the jury has the case and they have been deliberating for, I think, what, 6 hours now?
But oh, really? Is that today? Feels... Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I've fallen behind.
They got to start deliberating on Friday. Today is Monday, June 16th at the time of this recording. And so apparently they're still deliberating, and that makes me nervous.
Yeah, for her, for sure.
Yeah. But anyway, sorry, that's just a little aside. Yeah. But if you're listening, you know I've been following that case anyway. So, and I will, of course, let you know on the weekly docket what the verdict ends up being. Surely we're going to get one, like, this week, I would hope. Now, anyway, back to James Addy. On April 29th, he was found guilty, and at 54 years old, he was now a convicted murderer. In Missouri, first-degree murder carries a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole, which is exactly what the judge imposed. For the armed criminal action, which is the companion charge for using a weapon, the judge added a consecutive 10-year sentence. And there was some mention in the media of a 20-year sentence for the armed criminal action, but court records show that it was 10 years, likely the maximum, to be served after the life term. Regardless, it means James will be in prison until he dies.
Thank God.
Yes. When that verdict was read, James actually showed rare emotion. Some reports say he briefly collapsed or slumped over, perhaps realizing the reality of spending the rest of his life behind bars.
Yeah, it was totally for himself. It was not realizing what he did. It
yeah.
was realizing that he was going to stay in prison.
Yeah, and what a case of irony to go from being a prison guard to becoming an inmate.
Exactly.
Yeah. What a... The turntables.
Exactly.
Oh, the turntables.
Oh, how the turns table.
For Molly's family, there was a sense of justice, but also immense grief. They delivered victim impact statements at James's sentencing a few months later. One particularly heartbreaking statement came from Molly's young son, Declan, likely delivered through a representative given his age at the time. But he told James, quote, "You took away my mom from me." And by the end of his statement, there was not a dry eye in the courtroom. Molly's parents also spoke about the hole that her loss has left in their lives. During the sentencing hearing in July of 2021, James Addy did something bizarre. He chose to make a statement, not to apologize, of course, but to once again proclaim his innocence. And in doing so, he read a love letter to Molly, the very woman that he was convicted of killing. It was really an unsettling spectacle. He addressed the court, reciting a letter as if speaking to Molly in heaven, proclaiming his love for her. And many found this grotesque, understandably so. He never admitted guilt or showed true remorse. Instead, he used the opportunity to blame others. He claimed his defense attorney was ineffective, saying, quote, "The only one I hold at fault in this entire process is my attorney. He failed to present my case. There is no way that I could have done this crime," end quote. James even formally asked for a new trial at sentencing, which the judge promptly denied. And that's crazy to me that you can be well-versed, I think, in like the criminal justice field, being a corrections officer, and think that that's your moment to ask for a new trial after he just imposed a life sentence right. plus 10. But Melanie Addy, now officially James's ex-wife, was present at the sentencing and later said that she was not surprised by James's denials. She told 2020 that she believed James absolutely did this. In her view, James's problem was that his two-decade marriage and his seven-year affair were about to crash into each other, and his solution was murder. After the trial, life moved forward, albeit painfully, for Molly's loved ones. Declan is being raised by family, surrounded by the love of his grandparents, Molly's parents, who had to bury their child instead of watching her walk down the aisle. Molly's obituary noted how she loved her son and spending time with family. The wedding that was supposed to take place in Columbia, Missouri on April 29th never happened, and instead, on that date, Molly's family was likely planning her funeral service. They held a private graveside service for her in May of 2018 to say their goodbyes. As for James Addy, now 58 years old, he sits in a Missouri prison cell. He continues to claim he's innocent and has pursued appeals. In fact, he filed an appeal in 2022 arguing issues with the trial, like challenging the tire track evidence admission. However, the Missouri Court of Appeals upheld his conviction, finding no reversible errors. Barring any miracle for him, James will likely spend life behind bars with no chance of parole. The man who tried to have it all, a wife, a fiance, and a web of lies, ended up with nothing at all.
I hate him. What a despicable, horrible, horrible person.
Yeah, it really baffles me that people like this exist and then to just keep doubling down.
Right.
Thinking, like, what level of delusion do you have to be
exactly just
on mm-hmm. to think you can convince people right. that you're speaking the truth?
Yeah. Horrible. I hope he doesn't have any friends in prison.
Oh, I'm sure he's got awesome friends. I'm sure you're very popular. I hope you caught that Bridesmaid reference, but I would imagine that a short little guy like James Addy is becoming a baddie behind those prison cell walls.
He's found his bell in there.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
I'll be your beauty.
On that note, thank you so much for listening to this deep dive into the case of Molly Watson. We will be back next Tuesday with another case. And thank you so much, Daisy, for joining me on
this
episode.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate having you so much. I'm going to have you again for sure. And if you liked this episode, let me know. If you didn't like it, don't let me know. And with that, stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama, mystery out. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.